Self-awareness is almost always presented as a great thing. It has even become commonplace to condemn people for the sin of having no self-awareness. And this is not a new thing. The phrase, know thyself, was inscribed on the temple of Apollo all the way back in the 5th century BC. Self-awareness is one of those attributes we have decided is just good. But when there is so much consensus on an idea, it can be good practice to challenge it. So, allow me to advocate for the devil here. I want to explore all the ways in which self-awareness can go wrong. How, despite all its brilliance, it can also make our lives significantly worse. So, in the interests of biting the hand that feeds me, let's have a go at critiquing the very concept of self-awareness and self-reflection. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. 1. Paralyzed by thought. Analysis paralysis has become a bit of a buzz phrase, I suppose, in contemporary discourse. The idea here is that sometimes we think so much that we actually struggle to act. This term is used a lot in the sort of productivity sphere, where it's connected quite closely with procrastination. Say, for example, I'm trying to write a script. If I want to, I can think about writing the scripts to the nth degree. I can ponder the different directions it might take, and I can plan it in meticulous detail. I can do this so much that the actual job of writing the script just recedes into the distance and never actually gets done. Now, I'm not a productivity guru, but I do think that this is just an everyday version of a much wider phenomenon. That is, excessive cognition completely overriding our more instinctive ability to take action. And what's more, take action that feels authentic. And I have deliberately put that term in scare quotes. Those of you who've seen my videos before know that I think the word authentic can be unhelpfully vague, but I still think it's the best word to use in this context. This has already got quite abstract, but I think the best way to illustrate this general idea is with an example. Recently, I've been reading the work of the Japanese novelist Osamu Dazai, and specifically his book No Longer Human. I plan to do a whole video on that book, so I won't spoil it here. But anyway, in this novel, we follow the protagonist, Oba Yozo, as he navigates his slightly depressing life. The title refers to the character's feeling that he is, in some sense, separate to the rest of the human race. And one of the reasons he feels like this is because he is totally unable to act naturally. He has this baseline fear of other people, which in turn causes him to consider his every action in light of how they will react. He knows this makes his entire life a performance, but he can't help but go on performing. This gives him the strange sensation of viewing his own life from a third-person perspective, as if he were a video camera recording himself, or indeed, a novelist penning their own semi-autobiographical book. He often calls himself a clown or an actor because he is convinced that almost everything he does and almost every decision he makes is not really indicative of the him that he wants to exist, but rather is always passed through this overcognitive filter. It is the extreme opposite of when someone says something in anger without thinking and then protests that that wasn't really me. Oba Yozo does not feel inauthentic through lack of thought, but through overthinking. It is partly too much awareness of exactly what he's doing and why he's doing it that makes him feel no longer human. Of course, just because something is in a really quite good novel, that doesn't make it true. And it's quite difficult to study people's individual introspection at scale. So I will instead appeal to your own individual experiences. Can you think of times that you felt this sort of analysis paralysis? That is, not a total inability to act, but an inability to act in a natural or authentic feeling way, almost as if there is a blocked pipe somewhere in your psyche. I have certainly felt this at times, and it was deeply unpleasant. It made me feel like I was approaching life in a somewhat cynical or Machiavellian way, because my every move felt, from the inside at least, almost entirely calculated. But before moving on, if you want to make some meaningful sense out of the world around you, then you should check out today's very kind sponsor, Ground News. Ground News is a website and app that gathers related articles from thousands of sources around the world in one place, so you can compare how different outlets cover the same story. Each story comes with a clear breakdown of the political bias, factuality, ownership, and headlines of the reporting sources, with ratings backed by independent news monitoring organizations. Ground News are very kindly offering anyone who uses my link or scans my QR code 40% off their Vantage plan as a special deal, so I highly encourage you to snap this up. For instance, let's see how left and right-wing publications differed on a judge allowing 14 states to continue in their lawsuit against the Doge Department, while left-wing sources focused on the power that Elon Musk might wield or might have wielded in government. Right-wing sources pointed out that the judge also dismissed claims against Donald Trump himself. I especially like the Blind Spots feed, which highlights stories that are disproportionately covered by the left or the right. This feed helps readers step into the other side's news reality and understand the different narratives that can shape their beliefs, such as left-wing news sources missing a small recent rise in Trump's approval rating, or right-wing sources missing the potential effect that tariffs have had on the US tourist industry. I just don't have a lot of time to keep up with the news, and certainly not to examine every article that I read for bias. So receiving my Ground News roundup at the end of every single day means that I can get a variety of news opinions, learn which sources to trust, and just make the world less of a bewildering mess. Ground News is giving my viewers 40% off their unlimited access Vantage plan. They've genuinely become my go-to news source, and I really hope that you'll check them out. But anyway, back to the video. This general idea reminds me of a key theme in lots of Zen Buddhist writings, that cognition, when it's taken to its extremes, can be a hindrance rather than a help as far as human fulfillment is concerned. A great many Zen koans, or phrases to meditate upon, are deliberately difficult to grasp through cognition alone. The most famous of these are bizarre-seeming ones, like what's the sound of one hand clapping? But they do quite often involve themes of contradiction, duality, or apparently nonsensical ideas all unified together. The use of koans is a really fascinating part of Zen Buddhist history, and different practitioners use them in vastly different ways. But one general point that they all seem to cohere upon is that the koan is not a standard question to be answered, but rather a phrase to reflect upon and meditate with. The idea is to go beyond simply cognition and view the koan using different tools, often a mixture of intuition, thought, calmness, serenity, and focus. Sometimes the term non-conceptual meditation is used to describe this process. This doesn't mean that there is no use of the intellect at all, but rather the koan is not the sole purview of the intellect. As well as, hopefully, getting closer to enlightenment, practices like these help the Zen Buddhist get out of their own head and learn to see the world and themselves through a more balanced lens, at least according to Zen Buddhist teachings. You can think what you like about this particular practice or this particular belief system, but I think that it makes a point that stretches far beyond simply Buddhism. One of the repeated themes in Friedrich Nietzsche's later notebooks is that he began to consider a felt, meaningful engagement with life as less of a cognitive or purely philosophical problem and much more an emotional or will-based problem. He began to regard questions like, what is the point of my life, or why should I go on living, as signs that someone was already in the throes of nihilistic thinking. If their will was truly organized and strong, then these questions just wouldn't make sense to them. It's a bit like how, if you're in a really good mood, thinking about existential issues just doesn't trouble you in the same way that it might when you're alone in the house and struggling to sleep at 3 a.m. If you agree with him, then thinking about existential meaning as a purely cognitive issue where the right meaning just has to be found out in the world only draws us deeper into the nihilistic pit, since it tricks us into viewing the question in almost entirely the wrong way. It displaces us from the process of fully engaging with life, and so only heightens the sense of disconnection from life. This reminds me of an observation made by the philosopher Hubert Dreyfus about expertise, one that's since been backed up by quite a large amount of empirical evidence. Dreyfus contended that in truly skillful behavior, it was possible to think too much and thus hinder your overall performance. Sports psychologists like Steve Peters actually do report that a lot of their top athlete clients are desperately trying to get out of their own heads during their events. The idea here is that real expertise comes through enacting the habits that you've learned after years of careful training, rather than attempting to rethink everything from scratch there and then. If we take on board Aristotle's notion that our characters are largely made up of a series of habits, then this brings our observation about too much thinking hindering authentic feeling action much more into focus. To overconsider each one of your actions can disconnect you from the more instinctive habits that make up your character, at least at this moment in time. This disconnection might be appropriate if you're actively trying to change your character, but then the focus ought to be on habituating new behaviors and so crafting a new character with new virtues, rather than agonizing over each individual decision. At least, that would probably be Aristotle's advice. The common thread binding all of these ideas and observations together is that cognition, especially cognition focusing on the self, places some distance between us and our own lives. It's worth noting that this is also what makes cognition so great. The ability to view problems from an outside perspective and get as free from bias as we can possibly manage is what the whole scientific enterprise is partly based on. This distancing effect of cognition is also utilized in many types of therapy, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, which help interrupt downward spirals in our thoughts and allow us to distance ourselves from the raging current of our most turbulent emotional states. There is no questioning that cognition turned inwards is one of the most valuable tools we have. We certainly don't want to go to the other extreme, where we merely act on instinct, passion, and feeling. Nonetheless, just as we can have too little distance between us and the flow of our lives, we can also have too much. Obayozo has totally distanced himself from his instincts and his emotions, and this means he has no clue what kind of action would even feel meaningful to him. Again, this can sound very abstract, but it's just an extension of quite an intuitive idea. Imagine that you were trying to live without listening at all to your emotional feedback. You would have no clue what kind of action even felt right for you to do, what resonated with you not just at an intellectual level, but at an instinctive one as well. This excessive kind of active conscious cognition is just not in line with an understanding of the human as an embodied and habitual being as well as a thinking one. To bring this back to authenticity, a lot of the psychological literature on that topic draws a distinction between state authenticity, which is a kind of felt satisfaction with your actions, and trait authenticity, which is a property that someone ascribes to themselves in the long term. The philosophers in this section suggest that an excess of cognitive self-awareness can work against state authenticity. It can disentangle you from your more emotional and habitual aspects to such a great extent that both action and meaningful action become much more difficult. But, of course, this is just excessive cognition around the self. Oftentimes, self-awareness comes with another quite troubling playmate, self-criticism. 2. The self as object. The French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre used to talk about the look. The look is that moment where we see ourselves as if through the eyes of another person. Sartre's classic example is to imagine we are gazing through a keyhole in a door, immersed in whatever we're observing, when suddenly we hear footsteps and realize we are being watched. In that moment, we sort of take on that person's perspective. We try to model what they are seeing and, implicitly, what they are thinking about us. In this case, regardless of how innocent our intentions might be, we will worry that they'll think we are a bit of a creep, since looking through a keyhole is seen as quite a creepy thing to do for pretty good reason. For Sartre, this can be a deeply unpleasant experience, and he thinks that this look often characterizes our relationships with other people, or as existential philosophers tend to call other people, the other. Here, the other is seen as partly interfering with our direct engagement with our own lives by forcing us to take on their perspective, and all the ways we might not be living up to their expectations for us. We can already see a few similarities between this idea and the ones we discussed in the previous section. We can remember that the original spark for Obayozo's overcognitive approach to life was that he was scared of how other people would view him. But, of course, it rarely stops here. For a lot of people, excessive self-awareness quickly develops into excessive self-evaluation. That is, the semi-permanent adoption of the look, whether it's through the eyes of a real person or, as sometimes is common, an imagined ideal. This does make a certain sort of sense. Most of us have an ideal of what we want to be, and we hope that, at the very least, we are getting a little bit closer to that ideal. Most of us hope that we are, in some sense, close to it already. However, there often comes a moment in our developing self-awareness where we realize that we actually are really quite far from our ideal, and maybe the ideal that we're striving after actually isn't fully attainable after all. This is what Bernard Regenster calls nihilistic despair. Suddenly, the gulf between our ambitions and our position seems so large that it's borderline unbridgeable, and we react in one of two ways. We either lose our motivation to act entirely, since the pristine image that kept us going has been shattered, or we become extremely self-critical, beating ourselves up for not being closer to this ideal. I'm just speculating, but I suspect that the second reaction might happen if we view the ideal as still attainable in theory, but just not for us, and we remain in a uniquely wretched, damnable state. At this point, it is easy to use our own self-awareness as a kind of weapon with which to bludgeon ourselves. As I'll discuss later, we often know ourselves well enough to see all the ugly, cruel, or bestial parts of us, and we often don't like what we see. I'm going to loosely refer to this attitude as objectifying ourselves. This has taken on a lot of connotations in recent years, but at base level, it just means to perceive something or someone as an object. And in this sense, the overly self-critical approach fits the bill almost perfectly. This possible self-objectification is part of the special position that we hold as self-conscious beings. We can both treat ourselves as subjects, that is, simply experience the world through our own eyes, and as objects, that is, looking at our own lives and our own characters as things in the world. In some ways, this is a fantastic thing. It is what allows us to improve and consciously shape our lives. Without this ability, we would never realize where we genuinely were coming up short, or where we were betraying our own principles. Young children are much less adept at self-reflection than adults, and so they quite often have no stable principles. They're just hypocrites or moralists whenever it suits them. If an adult were to behave in this way, we would probably not be too fond of it. However, the danger is that we tip too far towards viewing ourselves mainly as objects, or, if you prefer, a sort of projects. The philosopher Byung-Chul Han discusses this a lot in his work. He talks about how many of us feel this internalized pressure to constantly be working or improving or producing, and how this will inevitably burn us out over the long term. But we can generalize this observation. It is not just the ideal of being productive that can be overemphasized. It is any ideal that consistently tells us that we just can't rest until we achieve it. At its best, a self-critical instinct lets us know how we can get closer to our ideals, but it's only a small step from you can improve to you are totally unworthy at this moment and must suffer as a result. This self-evaluative mode also comes with another danger that we've already somewhat touched upon. Since we have far greater access to the inner workings of our mind than we do anyone else's, self-awareness can make us acutely conscious of all of our worst aspects. We see this pushed to its extremes in certain people with obsessive-compulsive disorder, who often ruminate on their most chilling or disturbing intrusive thoughts, and use these to condemn themselves as fundamentally bad people with immoral minds. This kind of awareness can further solidify that sense of despair and self-loathing that we've already discussed. Of course, the implicit underpinning of this self-judgment is that we are bad compared with the people around us. That is, we do not just have these evil thoughts, but that we are the only ones that do. This is, again, simply a byproduct of two things. The first is that we have direct access to our own minds, but not other people's. And the second is that if you do happen to be more self-aware than your average person, then you are more likely to notice these cruel thoughts as cruel, rather than attempting to justify them or simply forgetting about them as soon as they pass. part of alleviating the pain of self-awareness here is to realize that you're probably not all that different to other people. They will also have cruel or disturbing thoughts and impulses. It's just that they might not be aware of them, or they might not admit them if they are aware of them. Additionally, we do not have to endorse these crueler thoughts as part of us. We can, to draw from the work of Somogyi Varga, reject them from our conception of the self and learn to move on. It is so easy to identify with these passing thoughts as we become aware of them. But simply because something flits through our minds does not mean that it represents a stable property that we have. It can just be a passing impression that is flung out of the chaos of our subconscious, rather than anything that is truly reflective of what we will do in the future or our habits of action. Luckily, reflecting on how other people will also have these unpleasant or disturbing thoughts will also help us to realize that perhaps our ideal of a perfect person ought to be adjusted. For many of us, the picture of who we want to be may just be totally unrealistic. This is all well and good so long as we realize that it's just something to strive towards rather than actually achieve. But if we imagine that we will genuinely become our ideal person one day, then this again encourages us to look at ourselves not as imperfect humans muddling along, trying to live up to our own values a little bit more each day, but as forever playing catch up to this person that we really think we ought to already be. It is where the urge to improve becomes the urge to condemn, and where simply noticing where we want to change becomes a cycle of perpetual self-evaluation where we always come up wanting. The trouble with this kind of self-awareness is that we're not wrong per se. We probably do fall short of our ideals. The trouble is instead with the framing of the ideal itself. It could be that the ideal is outright faulty. However much of a fan you are of productivity, you almost certainly don't just want the identity of a producer and nothing else. But it could also be that the ideal is no longer a positive one that you're trying to strive towards, but a negative one that you punish yourself for not already living up to. Maybe the following framing might help. To be endlessly self-critical is not the opposite of pride or self-obsession, but just another form of it. To ruminate on your own shortcomings is to be just as focused inwards as to aggrandize your strengths. Now, just make sure that you don't use that as another cudgel to hit yourself with. And I also want to note the structure that we used here. The self-awareness initially caused suffering, but upon further analysis, this suffering alerted us to an area where our whole framework had to be adjusted slightly. Hopefully, we are left with not only our suffering alleviated, but a more sophisticated view of the world. Put a pin in this general structure, as it will become very important in the final section. But next, I want to go beyond simply self-critique and into, perhaps, the darkest part of awareness and self-awareness, the pessimistic conclusions that it may bring in its wake. If you want to help me make more videos like this, then please consider supporting the channel by subscribing, either to the channel or, if you're feeling very generous, to the Patreon. The links are in the description. 3. The trouble with being conscious. In many ways, the central thought of the Romanian pessimist Emil Cioran's whole philosophy is, I learnt that and I didn't want to. Most of his works are collections of aphorisms or short essays which proclaim the futility, pointlessness, or indeed ugliness of concepts that someone might hold dear. For example, the very first aphorism of his work, A Short History of Decay, is a philosophical skewering of the concepts of sacredness and certainty as shortcuts to tyranny and malice. The fourth one is on the follies of taking life at all seriously. Occasionally, you will find an aphorism whose target is consciousness itself. Cioran often declares awareness or consciousness as a disease or a curse or a wound, and suggests that the primary result of such consciousness is to strip life of its more pleasant illusions. This is a theme that he inherited from his predecessor, Arthur Schopenhauer. For Schopenhauer, once you see life in plain and simple terms, it's just not a very pleasant place to be. That is, he thinks that life torments us, and then the awareness of that fact torments us still. A surprising amount of us have experienced some minor version of this epiphany. I have had a number of conversations with people about their troubles, and sometimes they'll say something like, I wish I were my dog. He doesn't have to worry about any of this stuff. The particular reason for choosing the dog is highly significant. The person believes that the dog is happier specifically because the dog cannot think in the way that they can. They are identifying awareness itself as the issue here and wish to retreat into the relative unawareness of their canine companion. It is another manifestation of that old adage, ignorance is bliss. The dog is an extreme example of this because dogs can't even ask troubling questions of themselves. They have no conception of ethics or of the state of the world. They can't conceive of themselves as dying someday or of wishing for there to be some meaning to orient their life around. They are content if their basic needs are met, at which point they drift off into peaceful unconsciousness to dream the rest of the day away. We humans are simply not wired like this. Way back in ancient Greece, the philosopher Epicurus realized that we have the quite extraordinary ability to create new desires as soon as our current ones are fulfilled. Schopenhauer and Choran touch upon much the same idea. According to the pessimists, we are simply not made to be content, and they vary as to how soluble they think this problem is. Choran arguably goes the furthest of all, whereas Schopenhauer and Epicurus both think that the will can be reined in and lessened, and thus suffering can be reined in and lessened along with it. Choran sometimes seems to argue that we are simply stuck with our desires and there is no real way out. The pessimists let us know that lasting satisfaction is, to a large extent, a myth, and that if we are striving after the day that we will simply be happy and content, then we are likely striving in vain. This discovery itself compounds the pessimist's dilemma. Choran especially treats it as an almost unbearable thing to learn. It is the moment where we realize that we are Sisyphus, pointlessly pushing the boulder up the hill, and our entire life is laid bare as a pointless exercise full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. If we humans were just a little bit less aware, we could have lived out our days without discovering this awful fact. After all, the dog's life is just as pointless, and they are also denied permanent satisfaction as they still have to eat and drink each day, but they hardly notice, and it certainly doesn't engender the same sense of meaninglessness that it does in many humans. This is partly what Choran and other pessimistic thinkers mean when they talk about consciousness as the human curse. I would argue that these sorts of things are also matters of self-awareness. The awareness here is of the position of ourselves in relation to an unfeeling universe. If Darzai's protagonist was paralyzed by self-awareness, and in the last section we saw how self-objectification can turn us into a vicious self-critic, then this form of self-awareness encourages despair by stripping our lives of the ultimately fictional stories that make them seem full and meaningful. Now, you may not agree with the pessimists, and I certainly have a few questions about their overall position. For example, they often lean heavily on the first noble truth of Buddhism, that life is suffering or life contains suffering, without paying too much attention to the third, that this suffering can also cease. But I want to use them to illustrate a more general principle. Awareness and self-awareness often rob us of the comforting tales that we tell ourselves, and this can increase our suffering. We discussed a pretty good example of this in the previous section. The moment where our self-awareness shows us just how far from our ideals we truly are is, in effect, the dissolution of a nice story. Previously, we had labored under the illusion that we were at least close to being the person we had always wanted to be, or that that was at very least in reach. And now that has crumbled to ashes in a crushing moment of realization. We even have a word for this kind of general process: disillusionment, or if you're more Weberian about it, disenchantment. The awareness that something we previously revered is either false or tainted. A part of the edifice which keeps despair at bay has collapsed. For the pessimist, one of the myths that has fallen apart is that existence will eventually bring satisfaction. For us, it may be a different story entirely. Maybe we will lose faith in the concept of a storybook romance or in the fundamental kindness of people. Or we will just truly realize that we're going to die someday. The point is not the definite conclusion that we come to, but rather the process of something that we held dear disintegrating before our eyes. This would simply not be possible were it not for our ability to be consciously aware and self-aware in a sophisticated manner. That is, the danger of awareness and of self-awareness is that we are much more likely to become disillusioned with something. Sometimes this disillusionment is a great thing. In their writings on cults, Stephanie Alice Baker et al. Describe just how important it is for cults to prevent their followers from becoming too aware of the cult's inner workings, or questioning their dogma too much, lest they lose their faith. But this positive example is a microcosm of a general trend that can bring both pleasure and suffering, that the more you critically examine something, the more likely it is to fall apart under this closer scrutiny. Thus, the more you examine your values or your ideals or what gets you up in the morning, the more likely you are to also discover their flaws. That is, unless you already have the perfect philosophical system at your fingertips, in which case please stop watching this video and immediately begin writing it down so we can all go home. What makes this kind of awareness so difficult is that, ultimately, it's still something that we desire. Most of us profess that we do not want a happy illusion, we want the truth, even if that truth shatters our previous conception of the world and all the false security that came along with it. Additionally, to be totally unaware in this way is to leave yourself open to manipulation. This is one reason why Mill argued that critical thinking is so vital for the healthy functioning of a free society. This awareness of where we've had the wool pulled over our eyes is incredibly valuable. But if you believe the pessimists, some of that wool might be necessary to enjoy life. But then this leaves us with a dilemma. What do we do with this excessive awareness and self-awareness that just goes along with being human? Is there a way to not sacrifice our critical thinking, but also not fall into despair? Well, after all of this devil's advocating, I would like to put in a little word in favor of self-awareness. For the only way out is through. In the 4th century BC, Plato made a simple yet brilliant observation about knowledge. When we don't have at least some justification for a belief, that belief becomes unstable. By the same token, when we do have a justification for a belief, it is very hard to shake. This is one of the reasons why I've criticized those theists who say to just believe in God. Our beliefs are just not quite up to us. Once we learn something or find a flaw in it, we simply cannot go back to a time where we didn't know that. In this way, an unpleasant realization is a little bit like a basilisk. If you look at it, the harm is already done. Sure, you can retreat into denial, but at the cost of some pretty severe cognitive dissonance. When it comes to learning something awful, the only way out is through. And that gives us a little bit of a hint as to what might help solve our crises of awareness. It may be that the answer is not less awareness, but even more of it. This reminds me of a point made by Kierkegaard in The Sickness Unto Death about despair. He argues that when someone first becomes aware of their despair, they may feel worse than when they were totally unconscious of it, and this may fool them into thinking that their situation has genuinely deteriorated further. But for Kierkegaard, the opposite is true. Whereas the person might be suffering more in the moment, they are also closer to solving their despair, since they are now conscious of it. Of course, Kierkegaard's particular solution to despair is to take a leap of faith and trust in his kind of theism, but we don't need to agree with his solution to take this general structure as instructive, especially if, as we just said, it is very difficult to become totally unaware of something once it's been brought to your attention. So, I would like to suggest the following rough framework for when we become disillusioned with something through our own awareness. Let's think back to our discussion of overly condemning ourselves for failing to live up to an unrealistic ideal of who we want to be. There, we had a sort of conversational interplay between reality on the one hand and a desired state on the other. There was how we are and how we want to be. And part of alleviating the pain of self-awareness here was to adjust the ideal so that it no longer caused such distress, either by changing it directly if we decided it was totally unrealistic or actually harmful, or by changing our attitude towards it to be something that we strive towards but never quite achieve, rather than something that we ought to be right now. I don't want to call this a dialectic, because I don't think that's true to how that term is normally used. but it does bear a passing resemblance to this process. We can also see this idea with early Buddhist approaches to the suffering involved in life that caused the pessimists such a headache. Confronted with the unpleasant realization that our desires and our attachments cause suffering, the Buddhist readjusts their ideal. Whereas before they may have wanted to fulfill their desires and retain their attachments for as long as possible, now they wish to let those attachments go and lessen the strength of their wills, at least if they choose to go down the ascetic path. Or take Oba Yozo, the self-torturing, over-cognitive protagonist of No Longer Human, whose name I'm probably butchering. Once he is in this crippling state of self-awareness, he can't just go back to acting naturally. The problem has to be tackled head-on. If he were to reflect upon why this excessive use of cognition was making his life such a misery, he might discover that he's not actually inhuman. It's just that his approach is preventing him from relaxing into life, so to speak. Sure, this is not something that could be solved overnight, but the only hope our unfortunate protagonist has is if he continues to probe his own mind for why he is like this. Although his self-awareness and his self-analysis have arguably caused his predicament, following this through is also his potential way out of it. I wanted to discuss this point, because when we look at the potential downsides of self-awareness, it's tempting to want to retreat into pure ignorance and claim that knowledge itself is a negative thing. But I don't think that this is true either. The irritating thing about this kind of awareness and self-awareness is that it both increases suffering and alleviates it. It can both dismantle your pre-existing ideals and create new ones to take their place. It can both paralyze you with endless rumination and make you understand how to develop a new character that doesn't fall prey to this rumination. It can both alert you to all the horrible things in the world and all the pessimistic aspects of the human condition, while also allowing you to develop philosophies to deal with this. To take us right back to the beginning of the video, we can think of this inner tension within self-awareness as a little bit like a Zen koan. It's not nearly as simple as just finding the middle ground between being too self-aware and not self-aware enough. Rather, the immense potential of self-awareness to enable scientific inquiry or personal understanding or improve our philosophies rests side by side with its ability to increase our internal suffering in a myriad ways. There is no neat way to resolve this tension because they work through the very same mechanism. The same tool that gives us the dispassionate theory crafting of empirical science also hands us the ability to totally disconnect ourselves from our own lives. And the self-analysis that allows us to improve is the same self-analysis that can become self-judgment and self-condemnation. I don't have a simple solution that allows us to have all the benefits of self-awareness with none of the drawbacks, and I highly doubt that there is one. And that is sort of the point. One of the reasons I wanted to make this video is that I suspect many of our other most valued properties will contain negative sides to them, just like this one. How many of our other greatly esteemed ideas like love or gratitude or respect or diligence genuinely do contain downsides that often go unacknowledged or not properly appreciated? I'm certainly not arguing that we ought to get rid of any of these, just as I'm not arguing we ought to get rid of self-awareness. But at the same time, it is worth occasionally taking stock of things that are supposedly unalloyed boons to see if we might want to nuance our view of them. From time to time, it may be worth playing devil's advocate with the ideas we have learnt to see as self-evidently good. Of course, the other option is that we just remain unaware. And given everything we've already said in this video, I'll let you decide which is the better path forward. But speaking of the darker aspects of things that we often view as uncomplicatedly good, I have a video on our ideals about love right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.